Column 3 contained Aquila's translation. Column 4, Symmachus' translation. Column 5 was the Septuagint, as revised somewhat by Origen. And column 6 was Theodosian's translation. Now, of course, this was an enormous work. It contained some 6,500 pages. Obviously, all manuscripts handwritten, because printing wasn't known for many, many centuries yet. So you never got this published, generally. Only one was known to have been made, and that was put in the library at Caesarea. Jerome, studying there when he was working on his Vulgate Latin translation, Jerome mentions having studied this Hexaplet in Caesarea in the 4th century. It was presumably destroyed when the Saracen Arabs captured Caesarea in 638 A.D. Now, you come to the Aramaic. Now, as far as the Old Testament is concerned, I don't imagine there's any particular importance to the Aramaic, because the Aramaic was not used in Palestine as the general language until after the Babylonian captivity. And you have the Sopharan text of the Hebrew adopted and recognized as official from only a little bit later than that. So I wouldn't expect to find in an Aramaic Old Testament any significant difference from the Hebrew. The Hebrew that they would have to put into Aramaic, and it would have to be a translation into Aramaic for the Old Testament, it would be the same Hebrew manuscripts on which what we have today are based. But for the New Testament, it's quite important. Aramaic was a Semitic dialect related to Hebrew, but not identical with it. Aramaic was spoken all over Western Asia. It was the language back in the Babylonian Assyrian area, and one of the languages commonly spoken way out in the west, even in Palestine. Now, Eastern Aramaic, I should say, was divided into two slightly varying dialects. There was the Northern Aramaic, which was Assyrian, and the Southern, which was the Babylonian Chaldean variety. Out in the west, up in Galilee and Syria, you had the Assyrian or Northern Aramaic, and down in Judea, you had the Babylonian Aramaic. Now, even today, you have no difficulty recognizing a New England Yankee or a Mississippian by the difference in his speech. And then in England, you get some of these people from Yorkshire and so on, and you can hardly understand them, although they're speaking what they consider to be English, and no doubt it is. So you can see how there can be these various dialects. Now, all the apostles, except Paul, were Galileans. They spoke this Northern Aramaic. And you remember when Jesus Christ was arrested and brought to the high priest's home, Peter was recognized as being probably a follower of Christ, because he was a Galilean, by his accent. Now, in the New Testament, all the idioms, all the manner of thought and speech are definitely Aramaic. Everything in the New Testament was unquestionably spoken originally in Aramaic, and all the real evidence is that it was written in Aramaic. The claim that all Western Asia had a Greek culture, is made only by those who pretend to be learned and are in fact ignorant. Now, Alexander conquered Asia with 45,000 Macedonian and Greek troops, plus natives enlisted in his army. After he had conquered one nation, why, he would enlist as many as he could of their fighting men in his army till he had a bigger one to go on and conquer the next nation with. Now, this was purely a predatory, military, plundering expedition. It had no missionary purpose of any kind. They weren't trying to spread Greek religion, Greek culture, Greek language. They were out to see what they could steal. Nothing more. Now, the Greeks, beginning with Alexander, held Western Asia for three centuries, but they did not succeed in imposing their language or customs, except, you might say, right along the Mediterranean coast. Western Syria, yes. Egypt, yes. Greece in the interior, no. Now, the Romans then came along, conquered almost the same area, not quite as far east as Alexander went. They held Asia for five centuries, and they had far better organization and administration than Alexander ever dreamed of, and there wasn't any place in all of Asia that adopted Latin as its language. Not in five centuries. Then the Saracen Arabs ruled for six centuries, and because Arabic is another Semitic dialect, closely related to Hebrew and Aramaic, Arabic was adopted as the language in some places in Asia, while in many other places the people would speak Arabic for what public purposes were necessary, and they still spoke Aramaic in their homes and their own businesses. Then the Turks ruled all that area for six centuries, and they never succeeded in imposing Turkish language or Turkish customs upon the people. So the idea that this little military plundering expedition turned all these people of Western Asia into enthusiastic Greeks is simply not founded on fact. Now, Christian churches were founded long before Paul's time. His work and his letters date from the mid-50s to the mid-60s A.D. And he tells you before his conversion, he was running around trying to stamp out these churches everywhere, even going as far as Damascus. Now, these churches had been based on teachings they got from Aramaic gospels. Nobody claims today that Matthew was written any later than 37 A.D., and they all admit that Matthew was originally written in Aramaic. With this, the conversion began. Now, Paul's first missionary journey was only to cities that were on the Asiatic mainland, as was also his third. In his second missionary journey, he did go to one city in Macedonia, Thessalonica, and to two cities in Greece, Corinth and Athens. But where did he go? Read the book of Acts, and it tells you that always when he went, even to Athens, he headed first for the synagogue. Now, Greek paganism and Roman paganism were bitterly hostile to Christianity. The idea of going there and getting on a soapbox and starting to convert these pagans is simply ridiculous. He had to get himself some start, and the place that would listen to him, at least until they found out whether they disagreed with him or not, was in the synagogue. Because Paul always started out trying to show them that Jesus Christ had fulfilled the Old Testament prophecies. That was the proof that he was the Christ, the Messiah. and none of the pagans had even heard of the Old Testament. So, the great probability is that Paul's letters, even to Corinth and the rest of them, were written originally in Aramaic and translated into Greek. The big process of translating into Greek occurred after the Emperor Constantine was converted to Christianity. You remember, he made his capital city Byzantium, later Constantinople. And they were trying then to use the Greek culture to build it up with and make converts among the Greeks. And from then on, you really had some major effort to translate the scriptures into Greek. Now, as to the Aramaic, basically, the Peshitta, it's a word that means simple, clear, and original or genuine. It's the Aramaic text, which everybody admits was written during the first century A.D. And the final form of the Peshitta was an Aramaic canon, definitely settled about A.D. 150. It omits several books that are in the Greek Old Testament, so you can see definitely it was not copied from the Greek. And furthermore, all known copies of the Peshitta agree. You don't have the differences that you find between various Greek manuscripts of the New Testament. Another reason for greater accuracy is the fact that the Eastern Church, Syria and Babylon and Persia, they lost all contact very early with either the Greek or Roman Catholic Church. From the time of the Arab uprising about the late 620s A.D., they were totally cut off from all contact with the West. So all the bitter controversies that arose between the Greek Catholic and the Roman Catholic Church over differences in doctrine were never even heard of where the Aramaic was spoken. With those controversies going on, there were some deliberate forgeries of manuscripts made by the monks in the monasteries, copying them, in order to support their differences in doctrine. But you never got any reason for forging the manuscript in the Aramaic. Then the manuscripts in Latin. Now these obviously had to be translations. First, the Old Latin. It was translated out of the Septuagint into Latin, probably at Carthage, in the 2nd century A.D. Its influence was short-lived. It was superseded a couple of centuries later by Jerome's Vulgate. Jerome made this translation into Latin between 383 and probably about 410 A.D. I don't mean we're uncertain when he worked on it, but it took that long for the process to become complete. It became the official Bible of the Catholic Church and still is to this day. It was revised somewhat in the 6th and the 9th centuries. It has some differences, of course, between it and the Protestant version, because Jerome was based on the Vulgate, on the Septuagint, I should say, the Vulgate based on the Septuagint, and there were, as I said, a number of substantial differences between the Hebrew and the Septuagint. Now coming to translations into other European languages, They began early, before the Catholic Church succeeded in stamping it out. In the 15th century, now remember, the 15th century begins with 1401 and ends in 1500. In the 15th century, a complete Bible, Old and New Testament, an anonymous work, went through 18 editions in Germany. Then Martin Luther made his translation, 1523 to 1534, based on the Vulgate for the Old Testament and Erasmus' Greek manuscript for the New Testament. Well, now, Erasmus' work was extremely faulty. He had access to only 10 Greek manuscripts. They were all very late, and all of them quite faulty. So the Greek edition that Erasmus published proved to be quite unreliable, but it was all they had. In Holland, Jacob van Liesveld published a Dutch translation of the Bible, 1526. In France, Olivetan, in 1535, issued the first Protestant version of the Bible. Old Testament based on the Hebrew, New Testament on the Greek. In Spain, in the 13th century, there was the Castilian Old Testament translated from the Hebrew. In 1569, Reina translated a complete Bible. Now, of course, the Catholic Church soon put a stop to all this, but it shows how people wanted to learn what was in the Bible. In Italy, Malherbe, in 1471, put out a complete Bible, and that was the earliest printed Bible. So remember, it was in the early 1500s that Martin Luther got out his translation. Bruccioli, in 1532, put out a complete Bible. And in 1607, Diodati put out a complete Bible in Italian. And his is still receiving some use there. As to early English translations and versions, prior to the 14th century, there probably was no complete Bible in English. But in the 7th and 8th centuries, portions, the Psalms, for example, portions were translated. Egbert, his work is still in existence. Aldhelm and Bede, their work has been lost, no surviving copy. In the 10th century, the Lindisfarne Gospels translated out of the Old Latin, and Elfric translated parts of the Old and New Testament from the Vulgate. And after that, there were several other translations of parts of the Bible. Complete Bibles in English begin with Wycliffe. His was published between 1379 and 1388. It existed in manuscript form only until 1850, the first time it was printed. But 170 of the old manuscript copies are still in existence. It was based on the Vulgate. Now, for some mysterious reason, he was not martyred by the Catholic Church. But in 1428, the Pope ordered his bones dug up and burned so there'd be no trace of him remaining. Then, Tyndale. And that's the great name in English Bible translation. He was murdered at the instigation of the Catholic Church in Belgium in 1536, but he had done his work. His Old Testament, based on the Hebrew, is New Testament on Erasmus Greek. And Tyndale discovered the great similarity between Hebrew and English idiom. He said, in translating from Hebrew into English, it is rarely necessary to do anything but just make a literal word-for-word translation. To try to translate from Hebrew into Latin is very difficult, because of the difference in idiom, you have to use the very roundabout way of getting the thought in Latin, and usually you can't get it accurately. But he said there is a natural affinity between the Hebrew and the English language, much greater than between the Hebrew and the Greek, the Hebrew and the Latin, or the Greek and the English. In the King James Version, 80% of the words in the New Testament are time-bound. It shows you what a remarkable work he did. Well, the English church authorities burned all the copies they could seize, but by 1528, 18,000 copies had been printed. And of course, it kept on at great volume. They were smuggled into England because, of course, the English priesthood were in every respect as bad as any of the other Roman Catholic priesthood. They wanted their monopoly. No one should be permitted to read the Bible because then he would decide for himself what it meant, and only the priest had the privilege of deciding what the Bible meant. Then comes Coverdale. He published his in 1535. It was really a revision rather than a new translation. He was not any great student of ancient languages, but he did have a very fine command of the English language. And as far as he could be sure of the meaning from the Hebrew and Greek, he put it into good English. Then what was called Matthew's Bible, published in 1537, the work of John Rogers. To avoid the bitter controversies over Tyndale, why he called this Matthew's Bible. It was really nothing but a revision of Tyndale, plus some small additions from Coverdale. But now this Matthew's Bible is the basis for all subsequent revisions of the Bible. Everything but other than a brand new translation. Well, Matthew's Bible was very popular, but in the form in which it was published, it wasn't elaborate enough to suit the church authorities. So they published the Great Bible, basically Matthew's, but just a fancier edition. And that was officially adopted for church use until the reign of Bloody Mary. Now this, of course, was a work about the size of a Webster's Unabridged Dictionary, and it was chained to the pulpit in the church, but members of the congregation could read it there at the church. Then in 1539, Taverner put out a version. The Old Testament was taken from Matthew's Bible, but he retranslated the New Testament. A few of his words are found in the King James Version. Then the Geneva Bible. Now, during Bloody Mary's reign, the Protestant reformers all had to flee from England because she was having them burnt at the stake as fast as she could get them arrested. So they fled to Geneva, and there they put out this Geneva Bible. The Old Testament was based on the Great Bible, which is practically Matthew's, as I said, and the New Testament was based on Tyndale. Its English was scholarly, idiomatic, forceful, a pretty good work, except, of course, it had the errors that were in the original manuscript, because Tyndale, of course, had nothing but Erasmus' Greek New Testament to work from. Then the Bishop's Bible, published in 1568. That was the official Church of England version. They tried desperately to suppress the Bible by burning all they could get hold of and murdering the translators and so on. They couldn't stop it, so they decided finally to put out their official version. But actually, it was just a revision of Matthew's Bible plus some small amount from the Geneva Bible. That was used for some 40 years. Then in 1609, the Catholic Douay version was published. The Catholic Church had become quite alarmed at the English translations, which all reflected the Protestant point of view. Because an honest translation of the Bible can't reflect the Catholic point of view. There are too many paganisms in Catholicism. So, the Catholic Church decided to put out their own English translation, which would be suitably tailored to reflect Catholic view. It was based on the Latin Vulgate. But the Catholic translators were so impressed with the sacredness of the Vulgate, actually it was a sacrilege to translate it at all and not leave it in the original Latin of the Vulgate. So they did kind of a hit or miss job on it, and particularly they followed the literal Latin so closely, where the idiom is greatly different from the English, that basically it's a poor job in English, altogether aside from any doctrinal differences. It is still the authorized version for English-speaking Catholics, although now it is not the only authorized version for the Catholics, because Knox's translation, 1950 is the date, is now also authorized. Then the King James Version, 1611. A committee of 54 revisers were appointed, and their orders were given. The bishop's Bible is to be as little changed as the truth of the original will permit. Unless you say that something in the bishop's Bible is just outright false, you can't change it. You've got to leave it as it was. But what they actually did, it was a revision of the great Bible, this big one, and that in turn was only a revision of Matthew's, which was a revision of Tyndale plus a little of Coverdale. So that basically Tyndale is the man who gave us our English Bible. Well, the known errors in it, as we found later, not known to be errors at the time of the translation, but we have today more than 100 times as many really ancient Greek manuscripts from which to judge how these words were used in ancient times. More than 100 times as many as were available to the translators of the King James Version. And it includes many much earlier manuscripts which don't have the errors that crept into the later ones. So, the English Revised Version was published from 1881 to 1885. Again, their instructions were the King James Version was to be altered as little as possible. In the New Testament alone, they made 5,788 changes, however, based on the older and better Greek manuscripts now available, plus some instances in which obsolete English words, which had lost their old meaning, were replaced by modern English. About 10 years later, you have the American Revised Version, which is very slightly different. It makes a few more changes. Now, when you come to modern English translations, there are Fenton. Accuracy really very high, and clear, readable English. Now, the thing at which I take issue with any of these translations is this. These translators will practically all say, I'm trying to get the general sense of it clear in English. And no one word of itself means anything in particular to me. Here's a verse, or we'd put several verses together to make a paragraph in English. And as I understand it, the general thing he was talking about was this. Now, they don't recognize that a single word, which may have made them wonder a little bit and perhaps change it to get smoother English, A single word may have been put in there because it had a special significance. And they will not alter the smoothness of their English translation in order to render that one particular word accurately. And sometimes that one word is extremely significant. And the original used that one word for a purpose. And that's why I've told you I cannot recommend any modern English translation as being 100% accurate. Smith and Goodspeed, again, pretty high accuracy, good readable English. Rotherham, now very high accuracy, but it leads to rather awkward English phraseology. A good work for study to make sure what it's all about, but I don't normally quote from it because the English is awkwardly phrased. Young, literal translation. That's the same Young who put out Young's Concordance. It's very useful. Sometimes the order of wording in the Hebrew is different from that in English. You wouldn't just translate word for word if you were going to use it as I do in a broadcast, for example. You'd have to change it around a bit to fit in English. But even that gives you some indication of how they thought in the old languages, and I refer to Young's literal fairly frequently in my studies. Now, Ronald Knox, an extremely brilliant Englishman, Protestant, converted to Catholicism, and finally ordered by the Catholic Church hierarchy to make a new modern English translation from the Vulgate. It's very clear English. I haven't checked it thoroughly for accuracy. But I will note this. He did not falsify the text in order to make it support the Catholic point of view. Page after page after page, you'll find somewhere in the page a little asterisk referring you to a footnote at the bottom. Now, in the text, it's very clear. It says thus and so. In the footnote, he says, however, the Catholic doctrine on this point is such and such, and that's the exact opposite of what the text says. So he was honest enough that he didn't falsify the text to make it support Catholic doctrine. Then Ivan Panin's numeric translation. You know, of course, that Latin had no separate numerals as such. Several letters of the alphabet served as numerals. Now, in the Hebrew and the Greek, they went farther than that. There were not only no numerals, but every single letter of the alphabet had a numerical value. Now, he discovered this, that if you add up the numerical value of every letter in a Hebrew or a Greek manuscript, you will find that every verse always comes out with a total, which is a multiple of 7. And then there are a number of other mathematical peculiarities. You will often find that a verse or a chapter will come out as something like 15 times 139. Not one over or one under, but come right out even. And other things like that. So he said, this gives us a test as to accuracy of the original manuscript. If you come to a verse which does not come out according to the mathematical formula that's so useful, then there's something wrong. There's a word in that verse that's the wrong word. Otherwise, it would have come out. And where you find differences in wording between different manuscripts, and one conforms to the mathematical formula and the other doesn't, he says, that indicates the one that conforms is the correct reading. Well, it appears to be a pretty careful and thorough job, although I would say the work is more on determining the accuracy of the original language than the work of translating into English. And finally, Lamsa, L-A-M-S-A, George Lamsa's translation from the Aramaic. Now, he admittedly follows the language of the King James Version in many places where he feels it's correct. There is no difference between that and the Aramaic in that particular verse. And because the King James Version is so familiar and so well-liked, and it is beautiful, obsolete English, but he has no quarrel with the accuracy, he follows it. But wherever the Aramaic differs, why, he translates exactly as the Aramaic is written. And every point that I have found thus far, where the Aramaic differs from the King James Version based on the Greek, the Aramaic is clearer and makes better sense. As I said, even Paul's writings become clear, simple, and make good sense in the Aramaic, and that's a lot more than I can say for a good deal of this work as it appears in the Greek. So, that's where your Bible came from. And that's the various principal forms that we have it in today.